Good afternoon. I'm going to entitle this one today, Patience. When we think about patience, we may think about the ability to endure hardship and suffering, affliction, and even persecution without giving up loss of faith and hope. Let's go to Romans 12:12. Romans 12:12 says, rejoicing in hope, patience in tribulation, continuing instead in prayer. I said, while we're in here, we'll go to James. I like James, for even in his day, James was not politically correct in any form. He's very blunt about anything he said. We'll go to James 1, starting at 2. My brethren, count it joy when you fall into diverse temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. But let patience have her own perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. And we'll stay with James and go to chapter 5. James chapter 5, we'll read 10 and 11. Take, my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering, affliction, and of patience. Behold, we count them happy which endure. You have heard that the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful. In this case, it could mean enduring, duration, and of tender mercies. But patience can also include the ability to endure someone being obnoxious, or even, well, sometimes it's very hard to tolerate the behavior of other people without responding in uncontrolled anger or showing sin in ourselves. So let's go to Proverbs. Go back to the Old Testament. Proverbs 15:18. A wrathful man stirreth up strife, but he that is slow to anger oppresseth strife. And go back a chapter in Proverbs 14:29. He that is slow to wrath is of great understanding, but he that is hasty in spirit excels folly. While patience helps control anger, it does not make it wrong to take appropriate action in hope of preventing the continuation of improper behavior of someone. There are times when loving patience must not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Leave any revenge about that person to a more wise and just God. Let's go back to Romans again, to Romans 12, same verse with chapter we was in. Go to Romans 12:19. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourself, for revenge giveth peace without wrath. It is written, revenge is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. For us to lovingly confront an offending person or even a brethren, it's not inconceivable with patience that sometimes we need to become stronger in our protest until their obnoxious behavior. I believe that we could look at the example of God and His long-suffering patience with the people of Israel and Judah. Through long years of repeated idolatry and rebellious by God's people, He had patience, but His patience did not keep Him from protesting against the way that His people were behaving. Repeatedly, He sent prophets to call them to repentance. When it became necessary, God was very strong in His warnings. Often God appealed to the Israelites, and at times their behavior got better, but it never stayed that way. They always fell back into what they were doing. And after Judah and Israel were ignored the warnings of God's prophets for centuries, He finally reached the end of His patience and sent them away from Him. And since we do not have the Eternal's ability to fully know what's in another person's heart, we must be careful when we feel we have reached the end of our patience. However, after kind but confrontation with the offending person, we may need to do as God did with Israel and set them away from us. It's just not good for a whole group or a family, any kind of organization where people have to function together. We may find it necessary to exile the offending person and separate ourselves from him or her. At the same time, we should strive in maintaining the compassionate and forgiving spirit of God that stands ready to restore the offender when he or she shows real change. That's what God did with Israel upon their repentance after years of captivity in Babylon. It is not necessary for a person to set patiently by and endure obnoxious or irreparable behavior by others. We can kindly but firmly confront their behavior. If they persist in their ways, that might come a time to protest strongly or even separate ourselves from such people. Above all, we must pray continuously for patience and faith in the Lord, and that will take care of us and guide us.
The title of this message is Message to a Divided Church. Message to a Divided Church. The Apostle Paul insulted the Corinthian church. We'll get to that in a minute. He insulted the Corinthian church. And what I suspect is that his insult would apply to the church age that we're in, to the church age that we're in right now. And let me qualify my statement by saying I'm not referring to any one person or any specific organization or organizations, plural. It's just a general church age observation. So let's go to the insult that Paul gave the Corinthian church. 1 Corinthians 3. And I was planning on us doing Corinthians in our weekly Bible study, so we'll get to discuss all these things more so as time goes on. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 1 through 3. And our brethren could not speak unto you, meaning the Corinthian church, as unto spiritual, but as unto carnal, even as unto babies in Christ. He's saying they're carnal and they're babies. I fed you with milk and not with meat, for hitherto you are not able to hear it or bear it, neither are you able. For are you yet carnal? For whereas there is among you envying and strife and divisions, are you not carnal and walk as men? So he's calling them spiritual babies and spiritually immature because of their divisions and squabbling. I'm saying this in a general, broad context. If you look at all the church groups in a general, broad context today, you would have to say we're divided. And at least in some areas, the divisions are increasing as time goes on. It's like something throwing off sparks. I remember at Pentecost, the EA and GTA wrote in there, we can cooperate with independent groups that wish to cooperate with us. And a number of them do. And matter of fact, one of our men on the programs at Pentecost was from an independent group. But I'm saying this as a generality. But overall, most groups will not work with other groups because of proselyting, fear of loss of power. You could add whatever other things you want to add to it. For the most part, that's true. And as I said, new divisions are arriving all along. To me, that means that we're not, at least as a whole, think as a group, we're not spiritually that mature. Because if we were, you'd have more cooperation and more unity. Now, let me first put a caveat to what I just said. It is obvious that if a major leader dies, that any organization or organizations will have a power vacuum and decline. So the loss of HWA and GTA, we automatically would expect a decline and some level of lack of unity. So I understand that. But even with that considered, I still believe the church could be more united and more cooperation between groups than we have now if people were more spiritual. And I'm not referring to any one person. You're talking about him or him. No, I'm speaking in general. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 4. For while one says, I'm of Paul, and another, I'm of Apollos, are you not carnal? So if people are putting up their leaders, and I'm only for this guy, and I'm only for that guy, and I'm for that guy, Paul is saying the way they're doing it is carnal. That's the kind of thing you see in the world. I'm for Che Guevara, I'm for Castro, or whatever, you know what I'm trying to say. We all have to grow as individuals to spiritual maturity where our core is focused on Christ and not on men, if that makes sense. And I believe some people will not be lost because they come to that spiritual maturity and they stay in the grace of Christ. Others won't reach that maturity and may be lost. Verse 5 through 7, Paul goes further. Who then is Paul? Who is Apollos? But ministers. Remember, the word minister means servant. Because I know that always, the minister of defense, the minister of finance, the word has taken on a meaning in today's English language that it didn't have originally. But minister means servant or servant leader. I guess technically our government serves us, right? We don't serve them. But at any rate, so who is Apollos? But ministers or servants by whom you believe, even as the Lord gave to every man. I have planted, that is, Paul obviously founded those churches, Apollos watered, and God gave them the increase. In other words, Paul didn't give the increase, God did. So then neither is he that plants anything, neither is he that waters, but God gives the increase. What he's saying is, don't put me, Paul, or Apollos. Some probably heard Peter when they went to Jerusalem at the for some of the festivals or heard him somewhere traveling around or Peter, don't put any of us up on a pedestal. He's on that pedestal, he's on that pedestal, and he's on that pedestal. Paul, really, he's saying we're not anything. And he's including himself in that discussion. We'll bring it back to balance in just a minute. So what's the problem with putting a leader on a pedestal? First of all, no leader is infallible. And I know you're going to say, well, saying that's obvious. Everybody knows that. But sometimes I think people forget it. One thing about the Bible unlike maybe some romance, some novels, you know, sci-fi novels, where the hero is perfect. He doesn't make mistakes. He's always on his game. But in the Bible, often Bible heroes, you see their weakness as well as their strength. Well, one of the greatest men, you know, Book of Acts on Pentecost, it said that David, a man after God's own heart, and actually one of the greatest heroes in the Bible, and he wrote Psalms and all the wonderful things about David, but David had Bathsheba. What about Abraham, father of the faithful? At least twice he lied. Now you're going to say, well, it was only a half lie, but the principle behind it was to lie to get himself out of trouble. Lack of faith. I'm not running Abraham down. I'm just saying that's in the Bible. What about Elijah? Elijah's faith kind of waned when Jezebel's assassins were after him and the people didn't rally around him. God told him to buck up. Now, you never think about Elijah as his faith waning. Or what about Peter and Barnabas, two of the great apostles? We went over this last week, but in Galatians 2, they showed obvious prejudice against Gentiles based on peer pressure from other Jews. And just read Galatians 2, and it's quite clear. And now, I'm not saying those men didn't repent of those mistakes, and I'm not saying they aren't great leaders, because that would be wrong. And, you know, they're great men, and we're just regular people. But the point I'm getting at is, even in the Bible heroes are not on a pedestal. And even Moses made the mistake at the rock about the water, you know, when he didn't give God the credit, and the people got on his nerves. And anyway, the point I'm getting at is, no one is perfect. So leaders are not infallible. But if you don't put them on a pedestal, if they have a problem and they fall and they break, you're not disillusioned. So if you put someone on a pedestal and something goes wrong and they fall and they shatter, well, you're more likely to be disheartened, disillusioned, because your hero has been shattered. Or you go to the other extreme, which is even worse. I call it the Kool-Aid drinker extreme. You put on blinders, and no matter what he does, no matter what he says, no matter what happens, he must be perfect. And I know most of you know the Jim Jones story. It's a ridiculous story, but most people know it. That when he did some unbelievable things, and his followers went along with it, near the end he told them to drink this poisonous Kool-Aid, because our government, with the cooperation of the South American government, was after him. So we're going to just commit suicide rather than have your leader arrested and investigated. And they did it. Well, a small number of other people had to shoot him. They didn't take it. But a few survived. But the vast majority drank the Kool-Aid. Now, you talk about, I don't want to see anything bad about my leader. I'm going to close my eyes and pretend he's infallible. Either extreme is bad. Think about it. Either getting disillusioned because you thought he was perfect and you found out he wasn't, or drinking the Kool-Aid. Either one is terrible. And I know this is unbelievable, I heard some people in the worldwide Church of God say after problems start to come, I don't care what so-and-so tells me. If he tells me to drink the Kool-Aid, I'll drink it. And I'm not making that up, because I know when you hear that, you think nobody in their right mind could say something, but a few people said something that outrageous. they probably know better by now, but I don't know. Who knows? They probably disillusioned and dropped out. But your faith is safer if you see your leaders as servant leaders, but still human beings who can fall and make mistakes. Now, you have to respect your leaders, but don't put them on a pedestal. And I think that's really what Paul is saying. He's also directing them as to the good leadership and not the bad leadership that existed there in Corinth. He was a good leadership, and people like Timothy that he sent. But the point I'm getting at, you need to respect leaders, but don't put them on a pedestal. And I believe many of the people in the Corinthian church were using the leaders like selfish icons that they could use to influence people. Well, I'm a Paul person. You all rally around me. You can see how that could work, right? I think even people are using a certain former major church leader who passed away many years ago. They're using his name and reputation like he's an infallible person, and you come follow me because I'm infallibly following the infallible leader. I'm not making that up. Some of you probably know what I mean. In other words, even if Apollos, Paul, and Peter weren't involved, other people used them like a magic talisman to get people to follow them, because I'm following him. Now, if you go to Jeremiah 7:19, I'm not going to read it, but if you go there, Jeremiah tells the people of Judah that God tells them that, look, you're worshiping these idols, but it doesn't hurt me, God. It's to your confusion and to your shame. I think the term is actually confusion of faith. In other words, anytime you do any idolatry pulls you away from the true God, it is in that sense bad for you, if that makes sense. And that's the principle behind Jeremiah 7:19. It's like an immature, I remember this when I was younger, so immature teenagers were squealing over the Beatles. And they were running around this big hotel. I think I saw some Beatles in the window. And they screamed. It was like the most unbelievable thing. And, you know, of course, I'm a guy, so I probably don't see it. Those mop tops are that cute? Give me a break. Now, I know Elvis was handsome and a good singer. But the way some people screamed over Elvis, it was like, it's unbelievable. Same with Michael Jackson, the things I read. And now I guess it's Justin Bieber. They call it Bieber fever. Well, don't you see how immature that is? And I guess Justin Bieber is cute as little teenage boys go, but still, you know, it's not worth all that Bieber fever. But that's a sign of immaturity. Well, Paul is telling you Corinthians, you're quarreling over leadership like little children. A leader should be a servant. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 3, verse 21. Let's see. 3:21. 1 Corinthians 3:21. Therefore, let no man glory in men. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? You know, your glory isn't, he's my hero. Oh, he's so fabulous, or whatever he is. I guess we can get that way over sports stars and rock stars and political stars and, you know, whatever. Therefore, let no, and religious leaders. Therefore, let no man glory in men, for all things are yours, whether Paul, Apollos, Cephas, that's Peter, or the world, or life, or death, or things present, or things to come, they're all yours. You are Christ, and Christ is God, 4:1. Let no man so account of us as of the ministers. Remember, the word minister means servant. If you think of it that way, it makes more sense. Let no man account of us as of the servants of Christ and stewards. Because a steward is kind of a servant, too. Stewards of the mysteries of God. They kind of take care of something. You know, a steward who takes care of the kitchen or the closet or the clothes in a big hotel. Or the baggage. In a sense, he's saying, we are servants of you church people. And I tell people, if you're going to be a leader at this church, you're going to serve, you're going to be working harder than anybody. Maybe those old days when the people served the ministry, said the ministry served the people, those days are gone. You're going to be serving a lot and probably not getting much appreciation for it. Well, it depends. And we actually push at our leadership meetings something called servant leadership. We'll probably do it again at the feast this year among leadership. Servant leadership. 1 Corinthians 11:1. Now, is Paul against leadership? Because you might misunderstand him. He says, 1 Corinthians 11:1, be you followers of me, that is the Apostle Paul, even as I also am of Christ. Now, that verse, I think, tells us two things. He's telling them there is good leadership that you should follow, and I'm it, and also he would send Timothy and others, you know, surrogates for him, to, you know, give him advice, obviously. And if you look at other of Paul's letters and Timothy and others, he tells Timothy who to ordain and who to promote and who not to. So clearly Paul was in charge, and Paul was clearly leading. So he's not against leadership. Because, face it, I've heard of groups where they say, we don't need any leaders. We don't need to have a plan, several groups, at least two that I know of. We'll just sit in a circle, get together, and we'll decide what to talk about when we get there. Be no preaching, no teaching. Those groups didn't make it. They didn't make it. It doesn't work. And I think it's clear, you do need teachers, because why would God give apostles and evangelists and pastors and teachers if they weren't needed? So you do need teachers, and you should, you know, follow the teachers as they follow the Bible. Now, I know there's a real touchy subject, as they follow the Bible. Here's what I would say in general. If you have one or two minor biblical differences with somebody, probably it's not essential that you all divide and fight and squabble over it. You know, nothing, you know, understanding of issues is not perfect, and there's room for some flexibility. However, if you sense that your leader is doing something weird, like saying parts of the Bible don't apply, or moving away from the holy days, or undermining the Sabbath, and maybe every little thing I wouldn't fight over, because they'd be careful. People say, I found a minor disagreement, I'm going off and do my thing. That's obviously counterproductive. So Paul is saying, follow him as he stays true to the Bible. And I really think as mature Christians, we can kind of tune up our truth detector, and we'll kind of know. But we have to, a mature person learns to cooperate with leaders, but never sees his boss as infallible. He's not, he knows there may be problems. He may even have to cover for his boss once or twice. Mature people know how to follow rules and be cooperative, because I think that's part of maturity. I want to tell you this story about a young man. I'm speaking in the words of a young man. Obviously, this isn't me. This young man goes in the store. He comes out after 5 minutes, and he saw a cop writing a ticket and putting the ticket on the windshield wiper of the car. He walks over to the cop. He says, hey, buddy, how about giving a guy a break? The policeman ignores him, keeps writing a ticket. He calls the policeman, you're a pencil-necked Nazi. He pulls out another pad and starts writing a second ticket for ball tires. Then the young man says, you know, when you were born, pig, the doctor shouldn't have slapped you, should have slapped your mother. The policeman pulls out another pass, starts writing another ticket. Well, this goes on for 20 minutes. He verbally abuses the policeman, and the policeman keeps writing tickets and putting them on the car, writing tickets. Every insult, another fine. The young man says, I don't really care, because I came on the bike. But I think even the term pig for policemen is really bad. That came out of the radicals in the 60s. But I really believe that immature people don't respect authority. And I'm not saying policemen don't make mistakes and judges don't make mistakes. But still, as a generality, mature people cooperate with authority. They cooperate with their bosses. They respect the mechanisms of whatever leadership organization they're in, and that helps create order, and they stay out of trouble, and you have less problems. People who are like this young man, he's headed for a life of problems, right? Some policemen might throw him in jail for, I don't know, they'll drum up some charge, but, you know, insulting an officer, whatever. But the point I'm getting at, if you're mature, you learn how to respect and cooperate. There are some people who've splintered out of the church that are almost that bad. They don't, you can't teach me anything. Nobody can tell me anything. Boy, that's a mature attitude, isn't it? I know everything I need to know. Like a 15-year-old teenager tells his dad, Dad, you're old and stuffy. You can't tell me anything. And then when he gets to be 35, he realizes, you know, maybe my dad wasn't so dumb after all, after problems in the world start to hit him. So let's talk for a minute how we can grow in spiritual maturity. So here's some thoughts. Number one, you got to remain humble and teachable. Everybody can learn, and all of us learn from stuff we read and hear and, you know, whatever. We can always learn more. I think the Bible is like a big onion. You can peel away layers, but there's always more depth. And even though I've read the book of Corinth 10 times already, there's still more depth underneath it if you just keep peeling and keep looking. we have to be humble and teachable. Secondly, never put a leader on a pedestal. When you say something like, somebody said this about a political leader, I don't care what he does, I'm going to follow him. That sounds like drinking Kool-Aid, doesn't it? No matter what he does. Now, I can see most reasonable things he does, but no matter what he does, that sounds like Jim Jones and the Kool-Aid. Number three, resist the end-time trend toward rebelliousness, headiness, and hedonism. Let's go to 2 Timothy. I want to show you what I mean by the end-time trend. And this is, of course, obviously a very scary scripture. And you, by the way, you're going to ask, how close to the end time are we? We really don't know. We think we're about 5, 6, 7, 8 years, maybe from the beast power and the temple in Jerusalem and the king of the south. Could be shorter, could be longer, obviously. But the direction you can clearly see. I think we can all see Europe's trying to unite. The Arabs are trying to unite. America's is declining financially and won't be able to remain the stabilizer of the world. Too many more years, they're going to start cutting the military. Anyway, I think we can see the trend. But also I think we can see the trend in human conduct. I heard some people describe to me recently some horrible crimes that happened in America. And I thought, yep, the conduct, the end time conduct is degenerating. Probably lack of families and lack of... Well, if you don't give people standards, and don't they pretty much teach there are no standards? If you don't give people standards, how can their conscience really guide them? Well, anything you do, it's your lifestyle. You do anything you want. Anyway, 2 Timothy 3, this is the one about how people will be in the end time. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. This know also in the last days, perilous, some translations say dangerous, dangerous times shall come. So here's how people will be, and it's probably going to get more and more like this as years go on. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, very self-centered, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection. You know, think about Casey Anthony. Oh, well, I don't know. Maybe that's not a good example. Truth breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good. Like good is bad and bad is good. Traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness. In other words, they might join a church and claim to be religious, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. Interesting, isn't it? Verse 7, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. In other words, they read different books about different things, but they never agree, okay, this is true. And on top of that, this is true. And on top of that, this is true. They just go in cycles. We don't know what truth is. It can be anything you want. It's all cyclical. And it means they come to no firm conclusions on truth. Now, as the world becomes more and more like that, can you see that God's church will have a harder time keeping group cohesion with those worldly influences on people? You know, especially denying the power of God and of the church. Clearly that will be the case. Or ever learning. Or being traitorous and despising those that are good. You can see those trends are going to make it harder on the church to be mature and be unified. So we need to push against those worldly influences that will make us self-centered, hedonistic. So you ask the question, what if my church gets taken over by people that are clearly going astray? I don't know, I'm not saying one or two minor disagreements. I mean, really clearly going astray. And I see them in a bad spirit. What should I do? Let's go to 3 John. There's an answer there, and I believe God takes care of his people. He will show you what to do in situations like that. We're going to go to 3 John. I know we're very familiar with it, but let's read it anyway. 3 John 9. And by the way, we assume that these people oppose the Apostle John. Here he is, probably a 90-some-year-old man who was with Christ you know, probably the last apostle to be alive, you know, a great man, a great leader. This Diotrephes has given him trouble. And I wrote unto the church, but Diotrephes, who loved to have the preeminence among them, received us not. So he wouldn't let John come in, and probably wouldn't let his letter be read in the church. Wherefore, if I come, I'll remember his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words. So he was attacking the Apostle John verbally. And not content therewith, neither does he himself receive the brethren. And he forbids them that would to cast them out of the church. In other words, if you talk to any of those people over there, we're kicking you out. And, you know, the fear of being shunned frightens people. And so you can clearly see an evil person taking over that church. So guess what John says, verse 11. Beloved, follow not that which is evil, but that which is good. He that doeth good is of God, but he that doeth evil has not seen God. Verse 12 is the key. Demetrius has a good report of all men. What he's saying is, organize yourselves, the one being kicked out of Diotrephes' church, organize yourself around Demetrius, because he is a good man. And I believe that when an apostasy comes along, there will be some true leadership. Everyone doesn't fall away. I don't think, you know, God won't allow the gates of hell to prevail against his church. God would not let it happen. There'll be some leaders that will stick with the truth. There'll be some leaders who'll be doing the right thing. It's our goal to find those good people and organize around them. Demetrius has a good report of all men and of the truth itself. Yea, we also bear record, and you know that our record is true. So that's what he's saying. I believe that is true. And I want to talk about tuning up your truth detector or improving spiritual eyesight so that you can see if something is spiritually going off track, you can see it and make adjustments. Well, if you take an art critic, there are counterfeits of Van Gogh and all the great artworks. I mean, really good counterfeits that only the art experts, and they got these little magnifying glasses and they know strokes and all kinds of little small things. They can spot a counterfeit. Some can spot a counterfeit $50 bill as well, the agents who work on it. But an uninformed person might buy the Van Gogh thing and it's a $3 million painting and it's really a counterfeit. Maybe a good one, same thing with a false counterfeit $100 bill, looks good. So how does the art expert or the Secret Service agent who's a counterfeit expert, how do they know? Well, they study in detail art, Van Gogh's painting strokes and all those other artistic things, or the money they're printing, and there are all kinds of little watermarks and stuff on money. They become experts. Their eyesight is good, and they usually can spot a forgery just like that. What we need to do is tune up our spiritual eyesight so that if leadership is apostatized or goes astray, you can spot it quickly and then find the good leadership to follow. So obviously studying the Bible a lot, praying for spiritual understanding, attend services. I remember when I left the Worldwide Church, I asked God to guide me and show me what to do, because I wasn't sure I was right. You always wonder, you're kidding yourself. Obviously, Worldwide did apostatize, and they were on their way just like I thought. I left about, probably 15 years before they officially announced that they were totally changing doctrine, but they were slowly changing them all along. But the point I'm getting is those who saw, we ask God to give us the insight. I think if you ask God in a sincere way, he'll give you the insight to see it, and you'll make the right decision. So the thing is, improve our spiritual eyesight, your Bible IQ, and you can detect things and start going astray. Remember three things. As we mature, and we should go for spiritual maturity. A mature person can handle the ups and downs and doesn't get rattled by it, and can remain humble and teachable and cooperative with other people. Humble, teachable, and cooperative. Secondly, never see any man as infallible, even if he looks so pious. I'm tempted to say even more so if he looks too pious. But regardless. And I bet when the man of sin comes, a lot of people in churches that know better will fall for this guy, because he's probably going to have charisma, and the media is going to play up his charisma, and he's going to look good, and they'll cover for him, and he will look infallible. But no man is infallible, no matter how pious he may look. And don't put any man on a pedestal, because people make mistakes all the time, even great people like Moses, you know, and Abraham and David and a whole bunch. And three, resist the end-time trend to be self-centered, angry, petulant, heady, uncooperative. You know, the things that were said, ever learning but never coming to any conclusions, and denying the power of God and the power of the church. Nobody can tell me anything. Those trends are coming. And as the years go on, we're going to see more and more, I think, especially young people, with that hedonistic, I'm going to do my own thing attitude. We should resist it, because it's a dangerous attitude, and it's dangerous to church unity and cohesion. And I believe if we do those three things, God will get us through, and we'll be able to keep the organization going, or make whatever changes we need to make, if and when we need to make them.